We're going to look today at Matthew chapter 13, I've entitled this The Kingdom and You. As you can see, it is a long chapter. We're not going to read it all, but we're going to start off with probably the most familiar verses in it, one of those stories that you heard, really, if you were brought up in a church situation, you probably heard it from your earliest day. So Matthew 13, I'm going to read at the beginning of the chapter, page 978 in the church Bibles. That same day, Jesus went out of the house and sat by the lake. Such large crowds gathered round him that he got into a boat and sat in it, while all the people stood on the shore. Then he told them many things in parables, saying, "A farmer went out to sow his seed. As he was scattering the seed, some fell along the path, and the birds came and ate it up. Some fell on rocky places where it did not have much soil. It sprang up quickly because the soil was shallow. But when the sun came up and the plants were scorched, they withered because they had no root. Other seed fell among thorns, which grew up and choked the plants. Still other seed fell on good soil, where it produced a crop 100, 60, or 30 times what was sown. He who has ears, let him hear." The thing about good stories is that you keep meeting people you know in them, people that you recognize. And as I reread Jesus' explanation of this story that he told and that we have read together, all sorts of images of people from the past years floated through my mind. I thought of a boy at a CSSM mission whose speciality was riding his bicycle between the speaker and the children while the speaker was trying to speak. This produced some challenges, you might have imagined. I remember talking to that boy when he was a young teenager, and one of his friends had been killed in a motorcycle accident. And I did my best just to use that situation to try and attract his attention, but nothing. I see him as a successful businessman now. As far as I know, nothing. I thought of a student all fired up and on a summer mission where he met and married his Christian wife. But then within a few years, only his career was left. He has a new wife and a new family and a good career now, but as far as I know, not God. I thought of a significant number of men whom I met during my working life who had once been active in their churches and were now nominal at best, and some of them not even that. I thought of a little girl of primary school age who turned up at a CSSM mission one summer and in the course of the mission announced to one of the workers that in the previous year she had become a Christian. And she was going on great. And we thought, wow, must be a good Christian home there and a good church. And we explored a little more. There was neither. It was a most unhelpful home, and I'm not even certain if there was any church connection. Speaking to her 35 years later, she was still rejoicing in her salvation, still active in the spread of the gospel. As we go through these stories this morning in chapter 13, there are 8 parables. And if we have ears to hear, in them we will meet ourselves. It may be encouraging. or it may be uncomfortable. These parables are about the kingdom. The title for this whole series is Make Way for the King, and kings have kingdoms. And these parables are about the kingdom. And oops, you thought you were going luck there, but no, we're going to start at point one. And point one, the first 23 verses are all about how the kingdom grows. Jesus told the story to the crowd, but he explained it to his disciples. Not to the crowd, but to his disciples. Because if you look at this whole chapter, it is primarily a teaching session for them. Maybe as he sat in his boat with a large crowd gathered on the shore, he was prompted by a farmer he saw further up the hillside. Perhaps a man with his bag of seed walking up and down his field, scattering the seed as he went. If it was being done today, of course, it would be being done by a machine, a precision drilling machine, which sets the machines precisely in rows in the field. But up until relatively recently, seed was sown by being scattered or being broadcast, which, of course, is an inherently imprecise method. Jesus tells us here that the seed is the message of the kingdom of God. So this is how the kingdom advances, by the word being broadcast. Now, not all the seed comes to fruition, because the birds eat some, the sun withers some, the weeds choke some, but some multiplies and produces really an extraordinary crop. 30, 60, 100 times what is sown. So then, how does the kingdom advance? It advances by a widely broadcast message with mixed results. Part of the reason for the mixed results, as Jesus goes on to explain to his disciples, is that responding to the kingdom is not primarily a matter of intelligence or even of understanding, but it is a matter of revelation. And many have set their ears and their eyes against hearing what God is saying and seeing what God is doing, as Jesus explains in verses 11 to 17. We nearly always think of this parable in terms of the gospel, the gospel message being spread. And of course, that's a totally valid application. But Jesus actually explains it in terms of the message of the kingdom, which seems to me to be a much wider thing. And so each of us this morning, whether non-believers, new believers, or aging believers, need to do a quick check as to what sort of soil this morning's word is falling into. It might be hard. It might be shallow. It might be crowded. It might be fertile. But just at this moment, at this point in our service, let each one of us be totally honest with God. What sort of soil is this message falling into? Am I not hearing it at all? Am I taking superficial decisions I know won't stick? Or are there crowded things in my life that really need to be dealt with? How the kingdom grows. The second big theme in this chapter that I want us to think about is the kingdom's growing season. As you know, if you're a gardener, and I'm really just a defensive gardener who goes out and hacks things down, I'm not so good at the constructive part of actually growing things. But if you actually have the skill to grow things, you'll know that there is a season within which they grow. Apparently, it is not a good idea to sort of plant potatoes in October. I shouldn't say things like this because somebody always comes and tells me afterwards that you can't actually do whatever I've said is impossible. But you get the reason. You get the point. There is a season for growing. And this chapter, in three sort of groups of verses, tells us something about that. In the first two, 24 to 30, Jesus tells another parable. In 36 to 43, he explains that parable. And then in 47 to 50, he tells another parable and gives this explanation. So, you know, Jesus is making absolutely certain here that his disciples understand what he's saying. So there are two parables, each with an explanation from Jesus. The first continues the agricultural theme, and the second takes up fishing. But both make similar but not quite identical points. In a world without selective weed killers and genetically modified seeds, the picture is quite easy to understand. The farmer sows his good seed, but as it starts to grow, it becomes apparent that all is not well. Lots of weeds are sprouting up, and they have been put there quite deliberately. What will he do? Will he go and immediately start weeding, with all the damage that will cause to the rest of the crop? Or would he with patience wait until the end of the season, when the weeds can easily be separated out and dealt with? The seeds here, in the picture Jesus tells, are now not words, but people. He makes that clear. He's talking about two classes of people here. And this is a lesson with at least two dimensions to it. The first one is this: God's merciful delay. How many times have you heard people say, perhaps how many times have we ourselves said, when we have looked around the world and we see all the absolutely awful things that are going on, and we need look no further than the last week, to be honest, how often have we said things like, why doesn't God do something? In preparing, I came across a story of a minister, and I'm not going to do this, so you can relax, but a minister who one morning said to his congregation, how many of you have been Christians for between 30 and 40 years? Quite a few put up their hands. How many of you have been Christians between 20 and 30 years? And some more put up their hands. How many of you have been Christians for 1 to 10 years? And some more put up their hands. How many of you have been Christians within the last year? And another sprinkling of people put up his hands. And then he said, aren't we all glad for God's merciful delay? You see, if God at the very first opportunity he had done something, none of us would be here today. Because the chance would have gone. We are here today because a gracious God has delayed. But what he has delayed is the inevitable. Because the second lesson in this parable is about God's decisive and divisive action. As the right time comes, God acts. 10 times in Matthew's gospel, the subject of eternal punishment is raised. On 8 occasions, it is raised by Jesus. I heard a very wise speaker say that a preacher who enjoys preaching about hell probably shouldn't be preaching at all. And I knew what he was getting at, because this is a sobering topic for a speaker to find in his text. It's not an easy message to hear, and it's not an easy message to deliver. But I'm so glad that I belong to a church where we deal with the whole Bible as it comes to us in our consecutive teaching. And that is where we have come to at this point this morning. Here it is, Jesus, who tells us that in the kingdom, that those in the kingdom and those not in the kingdom will be separated. Henry describes those who are not in the kingdom as the associates of sin. And everything that is in any way evil, Jesus says, will be cut off from God in a place described as a fiery furnace with weeping and despair. Jesus' words. You know, sometimes when you're preparing, you just come across something that puts what you want to say so much better than you can ever put it yourself. So I came across one of those, and I'd like to read it. I often find that when people read from books in the course of a sermon, I have the tendency to switch off. Please don't switch off. Listen to what this commentator says. There are certainly our caricatures of God and his judgment, which we should avoid like the plague. God is not a sadistic monster who would happily consign most of his beloved image-bearing creatures to eternal fire. But there are equal and opposite caricatures we should also beware of. God is not an indulgent grandparent, determined to spoil the youngsters rotten by letting them do whatever they like and still giving them sweets at the end of the day. We must refuse the second just as firmly as the first. And anyone who can't see that there is such a thing as serious and vicious evil in the world after all that's happened in the 20th century and is still happening now in the 21st is simply wearing the wrong spectacles. Anyone who doesn't hope and pray that the God who made the world will one day put it to rights is condemning themselves to regarding the world as, at best, a sick joke. But anyone who supposes that the true and living God, the world's creator, can put it to rights without confronting and defeating not only evil in the abstract, but those who have given their lives and energy to inventing and developing wickedness, profiting from it, luring others into it, and wreaking large-scale human devastation as a result, is asking for the moon. This is not to say that only large-scale and obvious wickedness will face God's judgment. There are, as we have seen, stern words in the Gospels about all of us being judged on every idle word we utter. This particular passage is not the place to discuss the finer points of how God's people become God's people. Granted that every single human being except Jesus himself is sinful, the parable with its interpretation isn't that kind of story. It works with stark categories that Jesus' hearers were familiar with. Wheat and weeds, good and bad, righteous and sinners. The second parable, 47 to 50, on this theme makes the same sort of point. Here Jesus envisages a fisherman with a great dragnet, the sort of net that just scoops up everything. They bring him to the shore, and the fishermen start to select the fish they want and the fish that are no good. And again, he makes it absolutely clear that we will understand this. The wicked from the righteous. And the same awful imagery of hell is reinforced. We are, of course, in God's eyes, all wicked by nature and practice. So it is only when we are covered by Jesus' righteousness, which happens when, in the language of this chapter, we enter the kingdom, that we will be secure. The kingdom's growing season. The kingdom's power. In between the parable of the weed and the wheat and the explanation of the parable of the weed and the wheat, there falls two little parables placed within the story and the between the story and the explanation. And they tell us something about the deceptive, even subversive power of the kingdom. The first is really about small beginnings. A tiny seed is planted, and this is not the mustard and cress you grew in on your windowsill when you were in primary school. This is a seed that grows into quite a large bush. But the seed itself is incredibly small. Once you plant it, you've lost it. You're not going to find it again once you put it in the soil and cover it over. Yet, give it time and it becomes a productive large bush so strong that its branches can support the weight of birds. There's so many levels on which we can understand this parable. How could the death of an obscure carpenter with a paltry band of cowardly followers 2 millennia ago have an impact on the lives of billions of people in our world in 2014? But it does. Daphne has already referred to something which struck us all on Wednesday evening as people were presented for application to become church member, of the way that so many of them came to faith in their lower primary ages. But in all rational thought, how could a decision made by a 5-year-old still be influencing their lives when they're 40 or 50 or 60 or 70? There's certainly no other decision they made at that age which had that impact. Small beginnings. Imperceptible movements. But the very power of God. Second parable tells us that while this power is not obvious in and of itself, its effects are enormous. The small amounts of yeast kneaded into the dough and the particular measures used here would be like 22 litres of dough, which would make a very big cake, I suspect, changes the entire lump. And when it's kneaded in, we can't see it. We probably, and I've never tried, but I guess we probably can't even taste it. And we certainly can't take it back out again. But over time, it does its work. And the dough matures and becomes useful, tasty, usable. And as we look across our world and across the history of our world, whole societies, whole cultures, whole families, whole churches have been and are being changed by this word of God. But let's not lose sight of the fact that this happens over a period of time. The seed needs time to grow and the yeast needs time to work. And God's time is always the right time, but it may not always be now. So Sunday school teachers, don't lose heart. Well, none of them are here because of teaching Sunday school. But let them know. Don't lose heart. The seed is planted. The yeast is kneaded into the dough. In God's good time, the power cannot be restrained. Patience is a Christian virtue. And then I would like you to think about the kingdom's value. This comes in two more very short parables in verses 44 to 46. And I put the heading, the kingdom's value, on it, but I guess the heading might better be put in the form of a question of what value do you place on the kingdom? Because these are parables about response. This morning, how do you and I respond to what God has been saying to us? The pictures are clear. In one case, there's a man out ploughing his field. His plough hits something that shouldn't be there, and he stops, and he ferrets about a bit, and he brings out, let's imagine, a tin cash box. And he opens it up, and there is treasure beyond his wildest dreams. And so he buries it back where he got it. And then he goes and he sells everything and buys a field. You may think that's doubtful morality, but in the rabbinical tradition, that would have been quite a moral and upright and acceptable thing to do. The second man is different. He's an expert. He has been collecting jewellery all his life. He knows a good pearl when he sees one. And he sees one. The greatest, most beautiful pearl he has ever seen before. And everything else has to go so that he can have this pearl. That's the value he places on it. These men had, in their separate ways, found something that they valued above everything else. I have, in the course of my life, on occasions, had to speak to investment analysis and financial managers and all that sort of good class of people. And they will talk to me about having, if I had enough money to have, they would have talked to me like this, about having a balanced portfolio. David, you want to spread the risks. You want some in shares, a little bit in gold, some in cash, a bit in property, some in emerging markets, some in the eastern markets. You want to try and smooth out all the risks. These men weren't like that at all. This was absolutely all or nothing. Everything went. The cash, the house, the family car, the golf clubs, the pension, the art collection, the lot went. So that in one case he could buy a field and in another case he could buy a pearl. The jewel merchant didn't add this pearl to his collection. He replaced the collection with his one pearl. And I was left asking myself, how does this compare with the value that I put on the kingdom? I had to be honest and say that very often I would have no problem at all about adding the pearl of the kingdom to my other pearls. But that isn't what this story is about. This story is about abandoning everything else because we assess what we have to be valuable beyond everything else. So these men are basically investors. And we ask ourselves the question, well, how did they come to this decision? How did they decide that this was a good investment to make? And the answer really comes at the end of the explanation of the previous parable we were talking about. You find it in verse 42, Jesus has been talking about the horrors of hell. But in verse 43, he says, then the righteous will shine like the sun in the kingdom of their Father. And these men had done the sums, made the assessment, come to their conclusion, taken the action, the question comes to us this morning. How do we value the kingdom? Someone described them as logically radical and consistently urgent, because you get a real sense of the urgency in this. You don't get the sense that somebody was doing a business plan or a risk analysis or seeking investment advice or going to their stockbroker. It was, it's there. I must have it. One man just seemed to stumble across it. Another man had been searching for years. And we know that's true. You know of people who came into a church maybe for the first or second time and they heard the message and God spoke to them and they walked out a different person from when they came in. You know people who have been thinking about this for years before they came to that point. So this parable really reflects real life. So how do we summarize it? In verse 51, Jesus asks his disciples if they have understood all these things. And they very confidently reply, yes. Now, with the perspective of history and from what we know of the disciples, I think we might be forgiven for suspecting that they didn't really understand it all with its depth and implications and perspective. But the point is this, they understood enough. They didn't have to understand all the depth of everything that Jesus said. They understood enough. And I guess that covers most of us this morning here. We wouldn't claim to understand it all. We wouldn't claim to be able to explain everything. Or even very much sometimes. But we understand enough. We understand enough to realize that the kingdom of God grows through the broadcast word. But there are mixed results. We understand that the kingdom grows in this present day, but a day is coming, a final certain day of just judgment with its just rewards for the decisions that we have made. We understand enough to know that the kingdom does grow with eternal dimensions and unstoppable power, but that its growth is not immediately often obvious. And that when it does happen, it happens to God's timetable. And we do understand that all of this demands a response. What value do we put on the kingdom? I have two questions to help you work your way towards a response. Two questions for you to answer. This is the first one. We've touched on it really at the beginning. When I'm getting to the end of this part of the service, so we've got to kind of update whatever we decided at the beginning about what sort of soil we were. As I'm sitting here responding to whatever God has been saying to you, and it'll be different in every case, what does my response at the moment say about me? Am I hard and impervious? Am I flighty and shallow? Do I really want to take it seriously, but I'm worried about 6 other things and emails that I want to send when I get home this afternoon? Or am I with full-hearted devotion to the King and the kingdom, wishing to take on board whatever it is God has been saying to me? Question one. Answers have implications. Always have. So in a sense, my second question is a question about implications. And it's this. What specific action will I take this week to confirm that I value the kingdom above everything else? At some point during the week, if this is a normal week for you and for me, at some point during the week there will be a decision, quite a small decision maybe, but an important decision in God's eyes that we will have to take to answer that question. It might involve ranking the kingdom ahead of something in our lives. It could be time. It could be something like Wednesday evening. Do I reckon the time spent with God's people? And I'm being slightly hypocritical here because I will actually be out of the country on Wednesday evening. But you know, it could be time. It could be money. A Christian demand on your wallet, and you know that if you meet it, something else will not be met. It could be a career decision. It could be that most difficult of situations where you're trying to balance the needs of your family with what you understand to be the clear demands of God. It could be something to do with recreation and relaxation. I don't know what it will be, because in every one of our cases it will be different. But it will be a deliberate choice. And so the question stands. What specific action will I, David McCracken, you put in your own name, take this week confirm that I value the kingdom above everything else?